Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what is the DOJ after in its quest to get voter data from states?
And what the new leader of the advocacy group for cities and towns hopes to see at the state capitol this year.
But first, former Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich has died. He was 59 years old. A statement from his family announced his death yesterday. A spokesperson says Brnovich died following a heart attack. Brnovich was elected AG in 2014, defeating the then incumbent Tom Horn in the GOP primary. He went on to serve two terms in the office before unsuccessfully running for U.S. Senate in 2022. Brnovich was also nominated by President Trump to be ambassador to Serbia, the country from which his parents immigrated, but that nomination was withdrawn late last year. With me now to talk about Mark Brnovich is Joe Canefield, a partner at the law firm Snell & Wilmer. He served as chief of staff in the Attorney General's office. Joe, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Mark.
So when you think about what Mark Brnovich, like what his philosophy was, especially in the AG's office, what comes to mind for you?
Oh, well, Mark very much cared about doing the right thing for the people of Arizona. And that was what drove every decision he made. He definitely was a conservative, a lifelong conservative, and that guided his principles. But at the end of the day, it was about doing right by the people of Arizona. And he, you know, loved this state and loved the people he served.
One of the sort of categories of law that a lot of people have been talking about is his work on consumer protection, lawsuits against Volkswagen and Theranos. He had a number of fairly high profile lawsuits during the pandemic about, companies that claimed that were making, kind of outrageous claims about what they could do in terms of protecting you from COVID. It seems like that kind of falls into what you were just talking about.
Yeah, that's right. The consumer protection is work was very important to Mark. That's protecting the people from fraudsters, deceptive advertising and marketing tactics by companies that, serve us all every day. And he took that work very seriously and was able to get some great results. You mentioned a few with Volkswagen and Theranos. The opioid settlement comes to mind. That was pretty significant to go after the companies that were supplying these drugs to folks and killing a lot of people. And Mark, wanted to fix that. I mean, it's still an ongoing problem, of course, but he made some great headway in that area. And we're very grateful to have been a part of that.
One of the other suits that got a lot of attention while he was in office was his lawsuit against the Arizona Board of Regents, suing over the cost of in-state tuition for Arizona residents to go to the three public universities. What were the conversations like in the office? Because that was a pretty controversial move, like suing an organization that he, at least in theory, was also representing.
Yes. So that predated me. Remember, I was his chief deputy and chief of staff during his second term.
Right.
So that all
yeah.
happened during his first term. But of course, I'm very familiar with all that. And I think it was important to Mark to manage tuition. I mean, he felt as a former graduate of Arizona State University and Mark and I both attended Arizona State University in the 80s when tuition was dramatically lower than it is now. And I think that was always a problem that he felt needed to be addressed in the skyrocketing cost of tuition and the justifications for that. And he felt that as Attorney General, he had the public support to ask those questions, to raise those issues, and to try to get to the root problem as to why tuition was going so high. So I think that was what was driving his decision to bring that lawsuit and try to lower tuition costs.
In listening to some interviews we had done with Mark Brnovich over the years, I was listening to one today where he is, of course, a well-known Grateful Dead fan. And he talked about how when he would talk, he would not go off a set list. He really just kind of said what was on his mind in interviews. I wonder if that was kind of how he was like just sort of in the workplace also.
Absolutely 100% correct. Mark was a lifelong deadhead, as you know, and he wasn't scripted. You know, he would have his talking points, but he always spoke from the heart, and he connected with the people. And there, you know, something about that was special. I worked for Governor Brewer as well, and and she had that. And has that ability, you know, to just connect the people. They just speak directly to the people. The people love what they have to say, love the way they say it and articulate it, and that sort of free spirited manner of about him was what made him so wonderful.
What was that like for you, as somebody who I imagine was trying to keep him on message?
Well, that was an interesting dynamic, and I'm sure some of my colleagues are listening right now. My job was to be the taskmaster and keep the trains running. So we would go into our staff meetings, and I had a stack of information to go through that Mark referred to in colorful terms, because I had to keep. But when he tuned in and paid attention, which he always did, and focused, you know, he had a very deliberative, thoughtful approach to dealing with every issue. He wanted to be heard. He wanted everyone to be heard in the room. And we had an excellent senior team. I can't say enough great things about the people that he assembled to help and counsel him. And there were different viewpoints in that room, and he listened to them all. And ultimately, he was the decision maker, but it was a very thoughtful and very deliberative process.
Joe, very, very quickly before I let you go, something else that he was very well known for was his love of nunchucks. Did he ever give you a lesson?
That it's funny you should bring the nunchucks up, because that happened the first week on the job for me.
Oh, wow.
And I'd never had a direct experience with the viral video. And I'll tell you that that thing went viral.
Yeah.
Some people loved it, and some people didn't like it. But at the end of the day, I think most people showed that he had a human side and he had a sense of humor. And he also was a pretty talented martial artist.
Yeah. All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Joe Canefield, a partner at the Phoenix law firm Snell and Wilmer, former chief of staff for Attorney General Mark Brnovich. Joe, thanks for your time. Thanks for helping us remember the former AG.
Thank you, Mark.
Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes says he will go to jail before he turns over voter data to the Department of Justice. And now the DOJ is suing him for it. Fontes' response has been abrupt. He posted a video on social media this week directed at DOJ civil rights attorney Jesus Osete.
We will see you apparently in court. And since you've chosen to use Twitter here as the means of communication, we will do that. But since you're not reading the letters and the refusals that we've already sent you, I will say it to you directly, Mr. Jesus Osete at the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. Again, sir, pound sand.
The DOJ is trying to get what looks like all 50 states to turn over their voter rolls. The government says it's to make sure federal voting laws are being followed. But our next guest says it looks like part of a concerted strategy by the Trump administration to undermine the next election. Eileen O'Connor is senior counsel in the voting rights group at the Brennan Center for Justice. And I spoke with her more about the DOJ's efforts and just what the federal government is trying to get.
The key here is that what the government is asking for is not only names, addresses, which are included in the publicly available versions of voter registration lists, but they're also asking for driver's license numbers and social security numbers, which are not publicly available.
Okay, so this is more information than the government already has about voters. I think a lot of people might assume, like, doesn't the government already know who I am?
So key distinction here between the federal government and the state government. State governments run elections. They're the ones who register voters, so they collect the information from voters, which includes driver's license or last four of social security number. The federal government does not maintain a list of voters, does not have this information. And instead, here, they're asking for all of the information that the state has in its voter registration lists. So names, addresses, full date of birth, social security numbers, driver's license numbers.
Okay, and that you say is unprecedented. Like the DOJ might request some information about voting systems from states at some point, but never like this.
That is correct. In each additional request that has come from the Department of Justice in this regard has just underscored how unprecedented and how unfounded these requests are. In the past, the Department of Justice, if there was reason to believe that a state was violating a certain statute, may have asked for information related to the voter rolls. Even then, it was very rare for the Department of Justice to ask for social security numbers and driver's license numbers for that very sensitive information. But here, they have asked for this information from, I think it's at least 47 states and the District of Columbia confirmed, and probably even more. That's just based on public reporting.
So our Secretary of State here in Arizona, Adrian Fontes, has refused to turn over this data. He's being sued now, among other states, by the DOJ for this data. And he says he can't turn it over even if he wanted to. He says it's a violation of state and federal law to do so. It has to do with privacy. Is that the case?
I haven't looked exactly at what the Secretary of State in Arizona has said in response to this lawsuit, but I can tell you that there are state laws in many states that address this and that provide privacy protections. But the key here is that the Department of Justice, the United States here, does not have the authority to ask for this information. It is claiming authority under the Civil Rights Act in most of these cases that it has filed. And it does not have the authority under the Civil Rights Act to sweep up the voter rolls from every state in the nation to go looking for things that it thinks are wrong or to use those voter rolls for some sort of other purposes to undermine our elections.
Right. And that's kind of the rub, right? Like, what do you think the DOJ is trying to get at here by obtaining this information? Like, do you think this is about undermining a future election?
That is a great question, and it is hard to know exactly what the plan is. There are a lot of very scary options. As most folks know, a lot of the leadership and staff in the Department of Justice, in the Civil Rights Division and the voting section in particular, are people who spent a lot of time and energy trying to deny the results of the 2020 election. That's the environment that we're working in. And in terms of the dangers of what they might do, one clue we got to that is there is a memorandum of understanding that the Department of Justice has been asking states to sign, which lays out some of their plans for using these voter rolls. And these memorandums say we are going to conduct our own analysis of your voter rolls, and then we're going to send you a list of people you should remove from those voter rolls, and in 45 days, you have to remove them.
So you say
So
this is
that.
part of like a concerted effort, it sounds like, by the federal government to sort of almost take over or be able to control those voter rolls?
Yes, the idea that the federal government would send a list of voters to remove is just out of left field.
Wow.
That is what the states do. The states have procedures, they have processes in place to maintain their voter rolls, and they have the expertise to do it. They have the databases that they, check their voter rolls against. They have specific processes laid out in, most states have statutes and regulations that lay these out. And they do those under the guardrails of the National Voter Registration Act, which is a federal law. The federral government doesn't have, they don't have the, the tools, the expertise, but most importantly, they don't have the authority to tell states who they should remove from their voter rolls. It's just not, it turns upside down the structure that's laid out in our Constitution and that is bolstered by federal and state law.
It sounds like this, though, is not happening for the most part. Like most states have not turned over this data, right?
There are a handful of states that have turned over the data. The state of Texas, and there are maybe seven or eight other states that have confirmed that they have turned over their full voter rolls. Remains to be seen what will happen in those states, but there are a handful of states. Most states have resisted this request,
Yeah.
and 24 of them have now been sued. Well, 23 plus the District of Columbia. But there are a handful that have handed over this information, and we don't know yet what will happen there.
Yeah, still watching that. Let me ask you lastly, though, about the idea of election fraud, voter fraud in general, right? Which has been, as you outlined there, such a topic in the last several election cycles. President Trump has talked about this and claimed that there was, massive voter fraud in the 2020 election, right? None of that has ever been proven, but I wonder, like, are there other implications? Like, do even the allegation of voter fraud make it harder for some people to vote? Like, would the possession of these voter rolls from the federal government have a chilling effect on certain people and their right to vote?
I think the handing over of these voter rolls may have a chilling effect on people's willingness to participate in the process. One of the pieces of information that is in a lot of these voter registration rolls, not all of them, but some of them, is voting history, by which I mean just the dates of the elections in which one participated, not, of course, anything about who you voted for. But voting history would include, did you vote in a Democratic or a Republican primary? Some states, these rolls would include the method of voting. So, did you vote by mail? Did you vote early in person? And knowing that certain ways of voting are under attack by this administration, and that certain viewpoints are also under attack by this administration, knowing that that information about one's participation in elections could be shared may have a chilling effect on the willingness of US citizens to participate in our democracy.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there for now. That is Eileen O'Connor, Senior Counsel in the Voting Rights Group at the Brennan Center for Justice, joining us to talk more about this lawsuit from the DOJ. Eileen, thank you for coming on. Thanks for taking the time to break this down for us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll visit a massive collection of advertising paraphernalia tucked inside an unassuming office building.
But first, among the myriad issues state lawmakers are likely to discuss in their just-started session is short-term rentals. For the last several years, there's been an effort to give cities back some of their ability to regulate that market. The state generally took it away in 2016. That issue is top of mind for my next guest. Renee Guillen is the new executive director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns, which advocates for the state's municipalities. Guillen has worked at the legislature and in the governor's office, which he believes gives him some insights into how lawmakers operate. Guillen came by the studio earlier to talk about some of his and his members' priorities in 2026.
I think maybe start specifically, I think some of the big issues we expect to see at the legislature, short-term rentals is a topic that we expect to see. Part of that is because we are pushing to introduce a couple of measures related to short-term rentals.
Sure.
Really, probably two proposals that you will hopefully see from legislators on our behalf. One of those is really getting to sort of, I guess, the nuisance side of short-term rentals. A lot of people think of those as like the party house, for example. Go with the stereotypical red Solo cups in the lawn or the loud music from a party that maybe goes too late. We have a process in state law currently that can lead to the revocation of a license. Unfortunately, that state law stipulates that you have to have three adjudicated violations within a year time period. Well, the reality is that getting through the court process that quickly is not feasible. So one of the things we're seeking to do is to increase that to three violations in a 24-month period.
Okay.
To give more tools to cities and towns to go after those bad actors. The other piece of legislation we'd be pursuing is looking to, again, restore some of that local control to where cities and towns could install caps on the number of short-term rentals in their community to really get at the, say, proliferation, the sheer number of short-term rentals in their community. So those are two pieces we're looking to push this year.
Well, so that issue, getting more local control over short-term rentals, has been sort of a perennial issue at the legislature, at least over the last some number of years. Do you have any measure of optimism that this year will be different than all the other times you've tried, you and others have tried to do this that haven't really gone anywhere?
You know, I guess I'm forever the optimist. So, you know, I guess I wouldn't be doing this for over, I guess, two decades now if I didn't have some level of optimism. But, you know, I think in terms of what's different this year, right? I always look to the that saying of doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result is the definition of insanity, right? So what I think we've seen now is that this really isn't a partisan issue. What we are seeing is more and more individuals are reaching a point where they are engaging with their local elected officials and they are engaging with their state elected officials. And so what we are seeing is really people of all political persuasions and sorry, I say people, but I mean legislators of all political persuasions that are now getting engaged in this issue. And so that's why I am more optimistic this year that we have a higher likelihood of seeing something move. And you know, anything we can do to kind of move that football to continue to drive the conversation at the Capitol, I will take that as a victory. And you know, sometimes it takes years to get legislation through. So we will continue to push this issue.
Let me ask you more broadly about housing, because that has been another really big issue at the Capitol that kind of like STRs, where it's not necessarily like a partisan issue, but there's been a lot of consternation between some members of the legislature and cities and trying to come up with ways to get more housing, more affordable housing. When you look at what 2026 might bring, do you get the sense that there might be some compromise between cities and towns and, let's, for lack of a better word, say housing advocates, like the folks with whom you've sort of been arguing with over the last couple of years, to come up with something that really can maybe produce more housing here?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. As you mentioned, speaking of perennial issues, right? Housing remains an issue. At the league and in my role, we're ready to sit down with anybody. And, you know, I would remind, you know, you and the listeners that there's probably at least a half dozen pieces of legislation that have passed over the last few years dealing with this housing crisis, trying to either cut out red tape or looking at the CASEDA law or looking at middle housing or looking at data reporting on housing. And a number of those pieces of legislation, my organization, the League of Arizona Cities and Towns, have actually been in support of. So we've been at the table offering solutions, working with those stakeholders on solutions. When it comes to any proposal we may see this year, we're ready, willing, and able to continue to talk about proposals. But I will say one of the things that – you know, I continue to hear from my leadership is we are interested in talking about real solutions that will lead to more housing getting built or that leads to real savings for the home buyer. We are not interested in legislation that's just going to be a corporate giveaway or a developer giveaway.
I wonder if there's maybe a sort of an inverse issue with this housing issue to what we were just talking about with short-term rentals, where with short-term rentals, cities and towns are trying to get back some of the control that they once had, whereas it seems as though at least part of the issue with some of the housing bills is cities not wanting to give away some of that local control and have the state sort of set these standards and set these regulations. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. Yeah. You know, my organization, we are sort of founded on two core principles, protecting our shared revenue and our local revenue and protecting local control, right? I mean, we are sort of founded on that Jeffersonian principle that the government closest to the people governs best.
How would you describe right now the relationship between the state and its cities and towns?
That's a great question. You know, there's no denying that there's friction, right? This is going to be kind of a long walk, so hopefully you'll bear with me.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the challenges that I see in my new role as executive director is education, and educating lawmakers I see as one of those. You know, I think lawmakers are sort of focused on sort of what I call the X and the Y, right? When they introduce a bill, they are focused on – let's use cities and towns. Cities and towns shall do X. Cities and towns shall not do Y, right? They're focused on the X and the Y. Me, as executive director and our organization, we're focused on the shall and shall not, right? It's really immaterial to me what the X or Y is, right? To me, my focus is the legislature is trying to move that decision point, right? They're moving it away from the mayor and council and they're moving it up to the state level. I'm sure the state lawmakers wouldn't like it if the federal government tried to move a decision point from the state level to the federal level, right? And so what's difficult is when lawmakers often introduce bills, they are focused on the X and Y, and often it's based off of a political issue they ran on or part of their political platform. For us, we are nonpartisan. We're not even looking at that. We are just saying that decision point needs to be with the local mayor and council because they are closer to the people. They're the ones running into their residents at the supermarket, at church, at the local function. They're the ones who know what's best for their community.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Renee Guillen, the new executive director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Renee, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yes. No, thank you so much for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
Good morning. You are listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. A new survey finds broad support in Arizona for traditional childhood vaccines. Think those kids get from birth to 2 years old, like polio, hepatitis, and measles, mumps, and rubella, or MMR. The survey was conducted on behalf of the advocacy group Arizona Families for Vaccines. It found 83% of respondents said these traditional vaccines are a good thing. That includes nearly 70% of Republicans. Around 90% of respondents believe these vaccines are safe and effective, and more than three quarters support requirements that Arizona students get these vaccines. All of this comes as childhood vaccination rates continue to fall nationwide and in Arizona, and Federal Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recently reduced the number of vaccines the CDC recommends for children. Notably, the poll did not ask about seasonal vaccines like those for the flu or COVID. Ashley Chambers is executive director of Arizona Families for Vaccines. She joins me to talk more about the survey. And Ashley, what surprised you in the results?
I think the thing that surprised me the most, and I would say pleasantly surprised me the most, is that there is so much anti-vaccine rhetoric out there. And so what surprised me the most is when we look at the outcome of this poll is despite all those really strong voices, the overwhelming majority of people in Arizona support traditional childhood vaccines, believe they are safe, believe they are effective at preventing serious disease and death, and want policymakers who will stand up for those traditional vaccines and emphasize the importance of those traditional vaccines. So I was really pleasantly surprised by that.
Why do you think it is? Like, why do you think there's this disconnect between, as your poll found, a pretty good amount of support for childhood vaccines, and yet people who are getting elected by presumably many of those same voters who do not believe that?
I think, and this is kind of a little bit of a broader spectrum, and maybe this speaks to politics in general, but I do think that there is a swath of voters who are single issue voters who really look for one thing. And I think that that applies to our lawmakers as well. There is a percentage of lawmakers, I can think of a few in particular, whose main issue is vaccine policy. And they really just talk about it a lot. And when an issue like that takes up a lot of person's time, whether that's a politician or whether that's someone in the general public, it can sort of seem like that sentiment is echoed by a lot of people when in fact it's really not. And another aspect of this that I think is really important to understand is that when you look at vaccination rates in terms of parents who actually immunize their kiddos against these really dangerous diseases, the overwhelming number of parents also immunize their kids, but they're not going out there and they're not publicizing it. They're not posting it on social media every time their kid got a vaccine. In contrast, a lot of people who have sort of fallen down this rabbit hole of misinformation, not only do they not vaccinate themselves or their kiddos, but they also sort of make it their mission, whether that's in person or whether that's online, as to spread these perceived, quote unquote, of what they believe to be dangers of vaccines.
I'm also curious about the seeming disconnect between what your poll found and the percentage of parents who choose not to vaccinate their kids, especially, you know, in places like Yavapai County. And, you know, we've seen in other places around the state, you know, vaccination rates, childhood vaccination rates are falling. It seems like that would sort of be at odds with what people told the pollsters here.
You know, I think it's a good point, and we know that vaccination rates vary wildly based off of where you live, even within counties. But I do think that overall, the poll showed that regardless of where you live, still the majority of people vaccinate their kiddos. But when you're talking about a place like Yavapai County, which has very low vaccination rates, still that's 75% of people in Yavapai County who vaccinate their kiddos. I mean, I think when you put it into perspective of if you asked a politician, hey, you got 75% of the voters in that district, is that something you're happy with? I think any politician would say, yes, I'm very happy with that.
So obviously your poll deals with the, as you call them, traditional childhood vaccine and do not look at things like the flu vaccine or the COVID vaccine or something that, that a lot of adults get later in life, the shingles vaccine, things like that. I wonder if you sort of have a gut feeling about whether if you were to have included those other vaccines, the level of support would have been roughly similar or different than what you found for the childhood vaccines.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, obviously we didn't include that in the data. I think my gut reaction is that it would be sort of a tiered effect. I think the support for these traditional childhood vaccines would be the strongest. I think the next level down of support would be the flu vaccine. And then I think the probably the least valued and appreciated would probably be the COVID vaccine in terms of, and I'm just talking about kiddos right now. I'm just talking about kids. Mm-hmm. I think you would probably be more likely to see parents. And I, you know, experienced this in conversations with my friends and kids that, you know, my kids play sports with. You know, I hear a lot of people who say that they did get the flu vaccine for their kids, but they didn't get the COVID vaccine for their kids. So I think that there is a sort of a, I would assume that there is a tiered level of support in terms of those other sort of more seasonal vaccines for their kiddos.
Sure. How would you like this data to be used when it comes to informing public policy or talking to policymakers?
I would really like this information to be used to show our politicians and our leaders in the Arizona legislature that these anti-vaccine bills that they have been putting forth and giving hearings to and passing, every Republican lawmaker last session voted to advance, not bills that would have increased access or confidence in vaccines, but would have sort of put either restrictions on vaccines or, you know, increased warnings on vaccine use, just to stop doing those policies, because this is not what the majority of Arizonans want. There was a question in our poll about whether people believed that it was the role of our politicians to protect public health. And overwhelmingly, across the political spectrum, people voted yes, that they wanted politicians to respect public health and to do policies that would protect public health. So I think that's a clear message from the voters to our legislature that what they are doing when they advance and vote for these anti-vaccine policies is out of step with what people want, what their constituents want, and what they actually do.
All right. That is Ashley Chambers, Executive Director of Arizona Families for Vaccines. Ashley, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
As a parent of little kids, I think a lot about screen time. How much should my kids be watching TV, looking at a phone, playing games on a tablet, learning on screens at school? It's a topic that's been debated and studied and legislated extensively, as all of us spend more time on screens for a lot of things all the time. But while a lot of the worry about screen time is focused on kids, our next guest says it's older people who are the real screen addicts. Tom Wainwright is media editor for The Economist, and in a recent article, he explores the ways in which technology is transforming old age, and for the worse, and maybe surprisingly, also for the better. Here is our conversation.
Well, for a long time, older people have been kind of champion television watchers. You know, for many, many years, they've had some of the highest rates of TV viewing. But they've tended to lag behind when it comes to digital devices. They've been less likely than younger people to have smartphones or tablets or to use the internet. And this is what has changed in recent years. We've now got this new generation of retirees who are retiring already fully familiar with their smartphones, with tablets, with the internet. And what we're seeing is that they are still watching as much TV as older generations have in the past. But on top of that, they are stacking extra hours of screen use through their phone, through their tablet, through their desktop. And it adds up to a huge amount of time. We've got pensioners now here in the UK spend probably more than half of all their waking hours using one type or another of screen.
Right, right. So, I mean, like most of the conversation, I have little kids. So most of the conversation I think about when I think about screen time is always about kids, right?
But yeah,
this is sort of the flip side of that. Tell us, you know, is it a problem, I guess? Like, is this something we should be concerned about?
I think it could be. I mean, I think it's worth saying up front that there are big benefits to this. You know, I think the internet could almost have been designed for older people. It's fantastic that people who might have more limited mobility can now do all this stuff from home, you know, whether that's online shopping or keeping up with family or attending doctor's appointments virtually, you know, huge benefits to all of this stuff. But there are risks as well. And just as people worry about younger people overdoing it on their screens, I think that some of those risks apply with older people too. And that could be anything from online scams to misinformation to loneliness maybe being caused if people are spending more time interacting with people virtually and less in person. So I think some of this conversation about young people's screen use perhaps could be redirected towards looking at older people's screen use too.
I want to get to some of those positives that you mentioned in a moment because I think they're really interesting. But let's talk for one more minute about some of the issues here. Like when we talk about vulnerabilities, like I think scams definitely comes to mind. But also I think of news as a journalist, right? Like there's so much misleading and misinformation out there. Is that a concern?
I think it is. I mean, it's a concern for all age groups, but I think there are a couple of things that I would particularly worry about with older people. One is that surveys show that older people who spend time online spend more of that time on news sites and apps than younger people do. So they're automatically already more exposed to this stuff than younger people.
Right.
The other thing that I think societies need to consider is that older people are much more likely than young people to vote. And so if misinformation starts to take root among older generations, it's kind of everyone's problem if that's a generation that's misinformed. And so I think this is something to keep an eye on. As older generations start spending less time in front of perhaps Fox News or the BBC or whatever they're watching now and spending more of that time watching YouTube or TikTok, these risks of misinformation are just going to get bigger. So I think that that is something that everybody needs to keep an eye on. And as AI becomes more of a thing, I think these online scams and fake videos and fake news of all kinds is just going to become more convincing and more dangerous for all of us.
Right. And people of that age might not have the same kind of, I guess, savvy when it comes to what's real and what's not online. Although with AI, maybe none of us will soon.
it's difficult for all of us, isn't it? But you would think that perhaps younger people who've grown up with AI from the beginning might be more likely to have that kind of instinct that maybe what they're seeing isn't true. We'll see. Yeah. It's a developing thing.
Yeah, that's new. So let's talk then about some of the benefits, though, because this I found very interesting. I assumed this would be kind of an all bad thing. But when you started looking into this, it sounds like it's not nearly all bad. In fact, there is some research that digital devices may be helping older people stay mentally fit, right?
That's right. I mean, there is some research showing that. There's some debate about what the direction of causation is. I mean, it's true that older people who spend more time with digital devices are mentally sharper than those who don't. It isn't totally clear whether it's the devices that cause that sharpness or whether it's the other way around and that sharper people spend more time online than people who are less mentally sharp. So yeah. there's some debate about which way it goes. But there are certainly benefits. I mean, I was speaking to a psychotherapist in the US and he was telling me about how he uses YouTube to, as a kind of, he called it a nostalgia machine. You know, it allows people to relive the media of their youth, whether that's TV or music. He told me he treated one elderly patient who was suffering from anxiety and depression using Google Street View, and he'd allowed her to relive the old walk from her old house to her old school. And, you know, this kind of thing, using VR in that case, virtual reality, this kind of thing is incredibly valuable. So I think it's important that we don't lose sight of this stuff. Just as with young people, they get enormous benefits from screen time as well as being exposed to risk. So yeah. There are definitely trade-offs here.
Yeah. And one of the things that one of the researchers you spoke with on this talked about was that maybe older people don't have the same kind of risks with smartphone, social media in particular, that young people do, because they already kind of have social connections, like they already know how they interact with people and the world.
I think that's right. I mean, with younger people, sometimes people have this worry about what they call social stunting. You know, if you spend all your teenage years chatting with people online and not in real life, maybe you won't develop those important life skills. By the time you're 60 or 70, you've probably already formed a lot of the key personal relationships in your life. You've probably already formed something of a kind of worldview. So maybe you're a bit less open to manipulation by kind of weird people online. I think another important thing also is just the opportunity cost of wasting a lot of time online is probably higher for young people than older people, because older people have a lot more leisure time than young people do.
Right.
And if you're an 18-year-old with a 5-hour-a-day TikTok habit, the cost of that could be failed exams and missed job interviews and so on. Mm-hmm. If you're retired, then really you have leisure time to spend as you wish. And if you want to spend 5 hours a day on TikTok, maybe that's a shame, but it might not have quite the same impact on the rest of your life as it
maybe
does if you're 16.
That's a shame, right? Let me end, Tom, by asking you about this idea of what the next frontier might look like here. You mentioned kind of virtual reality and that doctor that you spoke with who had a patient with depression kind of walk through her old haunts from childhood, which could be really interesting. Like, is this something that tech companies are looking at?
They are. And I mean, you can already see that older people are important customers for companies like Apple. Apple's wristwatches, for example, have echo electrocardiograms built in now. The AirPods have hearing aids built in. You know, there are lots of features now clearly aimed at older people. And I think we're just going to see more and more of this. There was one interesting piece of research I saw when researching this article showing that people in their 50s now, something like 20% now own a video game console, which astonished me. But I think that we're seeing, you know, generations of people now who grew up with this technology and as they enter retirement are now going to be familiar with it. So I wonder if we may have more people spending their retirement playing Call of Duty rather than golf.
Well, I guess the value of that is to be debated, but it's very interesting. That is Tom Wainwright, media editor of The Economist, joining us. Tom, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for your reporting here. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lauren.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. You may recognize the name Pollock from the marquee of various shopping centers and business parks around the valley. Or maybe you're a patron of Pollock Cinemas, Tempe's eccentric discount movie theater filled with life-sized figures of movie stars and characters. That theater, the collection inside of it, and pretty much anything else in town with the name Pollock on it is owned by Pollock Investments, which is run by Michael Pollock.
Pollock is a man of many business ventures, but he's also a man of many collections. And there's one Pollock building in Mesa that you've likely never heard of. More of that in a minute. When he was growing up in San Jose, California in the 70s, he used to buy old beer signs at flea markets, repair them, and resell them to antique stores.
I was making some real bank back then when I was only a teenager.
As the years went by, Pollack kept buying and selling, but he branched out to other types of advertisement displays. He has figures of all sizes, advertising anything from Alka-Seltzer to rodent control. Eventually, he stopped selling pieces from his collection. Now, most of it is tucked inside two large rooms in the office building of Pollack Investments in Mesa.
I've traveled all over the world to find pieces for this museum. Everything that's in here is specifically geared for advertising. There's nothing in here that you could just go buy.
The building is huge. It used to house a furniture store, and Pollack says it looked like a big warehouse when he acquired it. Outside, there are massive brown arches and a terracotta tile roof. Inside, there are tall white columns and lots of gold accents.
The shelves in the Pollack Advertising Museum are covered with items that would have been found in various types of stores and window displays. A 5-foot-tall Jolly Green Giant stands across an aisle from a large plastic Donkey Kong. A small army of tiny mannequins wear scaled-down women's lingerie. A larger-than-life foot with yellowing toenails advertises Corn Off. The walls are covered with beer signs, similar to the ones Pollack used to fix and resell as a teenager.
It's a lot to take in, particularly the bigger beer displays, most of them spinning around or moving in some way or another.
The one that's over here is a clown. And this particular display was made for several different brands. The one that you're seeing here was made for Bergy Beer. Those are original beer cans from the 1950s. They were drilled out so that the liquid was removed. They twirl, and then the little balls that are at the end turn at the same time to create even more motion. This has three motors that control it, one in the base itself. And see, he looks like he's drunk from the Bergy because you can see how he moves around on that base. The rest of them run on one motor. One of the very, very unique pieces here in the museum is this piece right here. This is a Ham's piece. The piece is designed on a motor scooter, and it says on the saying, "Look, Ma, no Ham's," instead of hands. There was only 4 of these ever made of this particular piece because it was just too expensive to manufacture. One of those was destroyed in a fire. And then there was 3 more, and I was fortunate enough to end up getting all 3 of them. Here's one of the newest additions to the museum. This is an incredible piece. I tracked it for more than 25 years, and I was finally able to get it. He is for Edgewood Whiskey. He's wearing an old-fashioned suit with the tails, kind of like a tux suit, and he's a jolly old boy that just has a good old time drinking his Edgewood whiskey. And basically, he is made of papier-mâché. He's from the 1920s. So imagine papier-mâché lasting almost 100 years. It's amazing. His eyes, there's a clockwork motor. He didn't run on electricity because they weren't using it back then. You would have to wind him up. And there's a special key that winds him up. And you see how bloodshot his eyes are? When you'd walk in the door of a liquor store, his eyes would be going back and forth and back and forth.
Rows and rows of shelves in the Advertising Museum house Behringer Motions, mechanical window displays that used to be rented out to jewelers. They were all produced between 1937 and 1959. The squeaky symphony you hear in the background is the sound of nearly every one of Pollack's 147 small Behringer displays moving at the same time.
This one is a flying saucer with a bride and a bridegroom, both looking around as the flying saucer is flying around. And what it says is, out of this world with one of our beautiful diamonds. Another one that's really incredible is one called Moonshot. And that's this one right here, built in 1957. And it was their creation of what it would look like to land on the moon. Some of them were just so intricate that it's unbelievable. Back in the day when these were done in 1945, 1950s, to have this much going on with one motor was unheard of. People would line up just for the unveiling of a new Behringer display, sometimes 15, 20 people deep to see this marvel of, you know, when you look at it and really study it, you've got, like, here on this piece, the gold furnace piece. You've got a woman typing. You've got a man working the furnace. You've got another man checking it. You've got another one going back and forth. You got another guy that's bringing the air into the furnace. And then you got the diamond pieces going around. That's a lot of stuff going on in one piece, especially with one motor. My goal has always been to be able to preserve history. And when you think about it, with over 8,000 or 9,000 pieces, amount of history that's in this room, because many of these pieces actually go back to the early 1800s. And so I look at it that I am the curator of this incredible history while I'm here on this earth.
That was Michael Pollack of Pollack Investments talking about his collection of advertising memorabilia, which is so big, he's created his own private museum in Mesa to display it. Now, you can't visit in person, but we will have photos of it on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. And that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. I kind of want some vegetables now, hearing about the Jolly Green Giant, right?
I just want to go to that museum. I wish I could get in.
It does seem pretty cool. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show.